From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 157 of Little Brother for the 12th of January, 2025. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com, or you can post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. Data brokers are companies who collect data from whoever has the ability to gather it. They collate it and correlate it and offer it up for sale. For instance, they may buy data from your automaker, your cell provider, or any number of websites or apps that you use or businesses that you patronize. They are used to paint a very detailed picture of the lives of individuals, as well as to identify any cohorts to which you might belong. There is also a dark side, as if that weren't dark enough, which is that law enforcement may purchase data from data brokers as a way to do an end run around the Fourth Amendment requirements for a warrant or probable cause. We'll talk more about that later in an interview with Alex Matthews of Restore the Fourth. However, the news here is that Gravy Analytics, alleged to be one of the brokers that law enforcement turned to for doing said end run, have been pwned and 17 terabytes of data exfiltrated, meaning that now all the threat actors have it too. At the Democratic National Convention last year, it appears as though an unknown party deployed a cell site simulator. Some of you will know these by the brand name Stingray. However, this may or may not have been that specific product, and it really doesn't matter. What does matter is that efforts were taking place to intercept communications at the convention. The activity was discovered by Wired, working with a technology that has been developed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation to seek out such technologies. There is no solid evidence to point to any particular actor as being behind the deployment of the simulator. Net neutrality has been killed by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in Cincinnati. Net neutrality is the principle that one group of bits on the internet will get treated the same as any other group of bits. It prevents internet service providers from approaching content providers and social media platforms and saying essentially, "Nice website you got there. It'd be a shame if it ran real slow-like." This situation is not hypothetical. 11 years ago, Verizon Fios users found themselves in the strange situation of having to use a VPN in order to get acceptable performance out of Netflix. The situation improved when Netflix began paying for better peering arrangements with Verizon, but of course, then all of the other ISPs wanted a piece of the action as well. In the meantime, small websites have got no chance at all. This is where we are headed back to. I'll post a link to an article from 2014 by way of bringing the receipts. And finally, I've discussed the emergency alert system a few times in the past. The most relevant component of it today comes in the form of notifications that are delivered to our cell phones. They can deliver information about weather, Amber Alerts, evacuation orders, and so on. Naturally, this has been a useful tool in the wildfire situation currently impacting Los Angeles. Unfortunately, there is a lot of anger right now because a widespread evacuation order was delivered to 10 million people, leading to panic and congestion, only to be rescinded shortly thereafter. Honestly, if you're in Los Angeles, you might wish to take steps to not be in Los Angeles, but a mass exodus clogs the roadways for people who are in immediate danger, which is the real danger in a false alert such as this. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned This Time. Opening up with the big one, the U.S. Treasury Department says that Chinese threat actors have breached Treasury workstations. The department says that there is no evidence that the attackers have pivoted into Treasury systems, but this is big. Really big. In fact, the department is using the term, checks notes, a major incident. Ya think? Anyway, the Treasury Department is working with the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, better known as CISA, to remediate the situation. The affected workstations have been taken offline. Now, this is purely speculation on my part, and I want to emphasize this, but given that it's workstations that got pwned, my suspicion is that somebody got fished. Finally, Volkswagen also got pwned in the past fortnight. According to Der Spiegel, all of Volkswagen's brands were impacted, including Volkswagen, Audi, Seat, and Skoda. So what did the threat actors harvest? Location data for 800,000 electric vehicles. You should be creeped out by that. There is no reason why automakers need to track the movements of vehicles that we buy. The transaction is simple. We hand over a truckload of money. They sign over the title to a truck. The title has the buyer's name on it, not that of the car maker. Not Volkswagen, nor any other car maker, has any business whatsoever knowing where the vehicles whose ownership they have transferred to buyers are located, full fucking stop. Fuck off already. Anyway, if the argument is that they will keep this information private, this should be the final nail in the coffin of that argument. We already know from prior episodes of this podcast that car makers are selling data to data brokers who are selling it to law enforcement. And to finish off the trifecta, if it escapes, then whatever security measures that they are taking are clearly not good enough. The only fix is for this data to stop being collected in the first place. I'm here with Alex Marthews of Restore the Fourth. Hello, Alex. Thank you for joining me on the show tonight.
Hello, Chuck. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, aside from the fact that I keep forgetting that the podcast could be listened to at any hour. So even though we are in the evening right now, Alex is joining us today, tonight, tomorrow, whenever you happen to be listening to the podcast. My audience is an audio-only audience, so they are not going to be able to see this wonderful T-shirt you are wearing. Tell us a little bit about your T-shirt.
Oh, that's just a merch T-shirt, but it is a black T-shirt, and it has in white 3D lettering on the front, "I do not consent to a search."
Fantastic stuff.
We have seen people who wear these shirts going through TSA checkpoints at the airport and then posting about their experience about it and going, yeah, actually wearing this shirt, like, not only was I able to not consent to having my image gathered for facial recognition purposes, but other people around me realized that they also had the option to refuse if they want it. Because, like, TSA doesn't make a big thing of your ability to refuse this, right? Not in their interest to do so. So we think that the T-shirts are good praxis. They encourage people to be mindful of the rights that they really do have, and that the government has spent a number of decades dishonoring systematically.
So, Alex, I'd like to start by asking you to tell me a little bit about who you are and telling me a little bit about who Restore the Fourth are.
Sure. I am the national chair of Restore the Fourth. I started getting interested in the whole topic of civil liberties and what we do online and the Fourth Amendment back in 2000-2001. I was at grad school in the Bay Area, and it was the time of the dot-com boom, and there was a lot of exciting stuff going on with the commercialization of the internet. I fell in with some folks at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I did an internship there for a while. They apparently wanted a British voice, and I was only recently arrived from the United Kingdom. They wanted somebody who could speak to what was happening then in terms of investigatory powers and the regulation thereof in the UK setting. But what I also found was that at UC Berkeley at that time, I was at policy school, and there was an awful lot of sophisticated thinking going on, for example, healthcare economics or housing or welfare provision of various kinds. But there wasn't a single course that was probing into this new phenomenon of the commercial internet. I helped to design UC Berkeley's first course on what we were calling cyber law at the time. Thing is, at that time, the whole sphere of online civil liberties and what to do with it was a very, very small field. And so finding an actual job for which people would pay me a recognized currency in the space was more challenging than you might think. But I continued to be interested and worried by what the Bush administration was up to. There is much I still haven't forgiven them for and never will. But the whole warrantless surveillance scandal, what they were doing with military commissions, the distinctions they were placing between a nominal protection of the rights of US citizens and a complete dismissal of the rights of everybody else were troubling to me. So by that time, I had gotten US citizenship, and I was in a position where I had the choice as to whether I would work on other people's causes or whether I could set up a nonprofit and work on a cause myself. This was a cause I desperately cared about, and I set up a small activist group in Massachusetts in 2012, working on questions of wiretapping and privacy and surveillance. And then 10 months later, Edward Snowden comes out of the NSA. And at that juncture, protest groups start springing up and self-organizing on Reddit. He came out of the NSA in early June, and these groups wanted to hold a big protest on July 4th of that year, and they started organizing around the slogan of Restore the Fourth.
Ah.
Yeah. There were rallies in over 100 cities, not just in the US, but in Canada and in Western Europe and a few other places. And the folks who were running that started to do more organizing and more protesting, and there were daily intense IRC chats. And by the fall, a lot of folks were getting a little bit burned out, and some folks needed to sort of go and earn money for a living. rather than working full-time on something they weren't being paid for. So they started looking around Christmas of 2013 for a new national chair who could help them figure out what do we do when we are not necessarily going to be on the streets every week? What kinds of policy agenda should we pursue? How can we actually stop this array of government surveillance, or at least throw sand in the gears of it? Develop a strategy, incorporate it as a nonprofit, raise a little money. It would help if the person had some nonprofit experience and didn't necessarily immediately need a salary right then. So I applied, a few other people applied, and they picked me, and I've remained as national chair since then. I folded my own organization into Restore the Fourth. Chapters continued in other places. We have chapters, for example, in Minneapolis and in Providence and New York City and in the San Francisco Bay Area and associated groups in Seattle and New Orleans and, you know, different places.
I wanted to go back and revisit your time in the Bay Area.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about 99 through to 05 was the time I was there.
Now, what I find fascinating about this particular aspect of your life is that, to my understanding, you're not an overly technical person.
No. My professional background is in public policy. My college major was medieval literature.
Which I'm sure has come in very handy in this pursuit.
Absolutely. I would never admit to anything else. But what it does mean is that we have a lot of technical people with high skills involved with Restore the Fourth. It's a good fit for people who are of a technical mindset, who want to be able to find ways of translating that expertise in a way that's intelligible for lawmakers. We all know that members of Congress don't tend to have technical backgrounds either. They don't tend to know what they're doing when they're trying to regulate the internet one way or another. So it can help to have somebody or multiple somebodies who are used to the language of policy trying to help tech-oriented people figure out what to say and how to say it. But it is true that because of this sort of background and configuration of Restore the Fourth, we have been called the nerdiest civil liberties organization on the Hill.
Very nice.
That's great. I love that.
One of the things that I find interesting about this, too, is that for the listeners, I will mention that we are carrying out this conversation using Signal Private Messenger, which is, in my opinion, a particularly nerdy tool to use. So I find it interesting that somebody who is not of a particularly technical background has chosen this tool.
Well, first of all, God bless the Signal Foundation. I love those guys. Second, when we started off with this organization, we were trying to use PGP email internally.
Oh, heaven help you.
It was not the easiest thing and still is not. I very much respect the peer-to-peer nature of PGP communication, but that I had a lot of trouble with.
Yes, indeed.
So having a tool that honestly is very user-friendly compared to PGP is wonderful. And I can comfortably recommend it to everyone that I get in contact with in this policy space. It's difficult for elected officials to use, not because it's hard to use in itself, but because there is a conflict between using a properly end-to-end encrypted system and public records laws.
Sure, okay, that's an understandable conflict. From my perspective, I understand PGP well enough to use it. I still, even as a technical individual, don't find it easy to use. So I certainly can feel your pain on that one. But Signal is just a simple load and go, and it seems to work well enough. I've spoken before, and I will mention again, one particularly noteworthy thing about the Signal Foundation is that they do occasionally get a subpoena. And when they respond to these subpoenas, it's hilarious because these subpoenas have got this big, long list of things that the agency or whoever is issuing the subpoena would love to get from the Signal Foundation. And the Signal Foundation says, we have a phone number and we have a time at which the account was first and most recently used. Sorry, yep, that's all we got.
Can't do anything more. And that is as it should be. As a last note on Signal, one conversation I'm engaging with other civil liberties advocacy people is trying to encourage them when they're having video calls and strategy calls to switch that environment over to Signal, because we are literally doing organizing against government surveillance. Why would we not organize using a platform that is not going to be able to give metadata when faced with a subpoena? We don't want our opponents to be able to straightforwardly map our networks.
So talk to us a little bit about the little snitch in your pocket, as I like to call it.
Oh boy, the indispensable snitch in your pocket. This is the problem. An enormous amount of modern life is run through the snitches in our pockets. And I think that it is unfair to expect people to diverge entirely away from using a tool that is so radically convenient and makes so many things easier in their lives. There are going to be some people who consciously do diverge away from that, and I respect that immensely. But I think that there are important ways that one can try to use phones in more secure and intelligent ways. And the education that we can provide there is by, for example, talking about data breaches and exploitation of information that is gathered through people's phones, talking about the ecosystem of snitch apps. For example, I have 4 kids. They have a ton of apps that on the surface are exciting little hamster games where you can have your hamster get exciting little bits of food. And underneath the surface, they are sharing data with 47 different data brokers, plus a couple of nation states, probably including Al-Qaeda, you know. So I'm aware that there are risks involved in the Al-Qaeda hamster game.
I'm amused by that because I'm a father of 2 myself, and at one point in time, I had to give my son explicit instructions that the Amazon Dot that he had won at the arcade was never, ever to appear on the household Wi-Fi network if he wanted to retain his access. So I completely feel your pain on that one.
It happens. But, you know, there are better and there are worse apps, there is better and worse hardware. I think the important thing for people to be conscious of is that when they are signing up for a service or when they are purchasing hardware, a lot comes with those agreements. And there are a lot of generally very permissive arrangements in terms of how law enforcement requests for data work from those services and from those hardware providers. And so you have to be aware of what you are getting into, and therefore you can modulate what you put online and what you put on what hardware and what software you use and for what purpose. So a more conscious use is helpful. That, of course, is not the only thing that one can do, because that still leaves people very vulnerable. What we therefore do is we focus legislatively on matters to do with data brokers, matters to do particularly with the interface between data brokers and government acquisition of data broker data, and try to ensure that there is some kind of wall of separation, that the expectation is that more companies will do the kind of things that Signal do. They will structure themselves such that they are not collecting sensitive data if they don't really need it. that they are not retaining data beyond its useful life. That if they do collect and retain data, then they have a sensible process whereby they're not simply saying yes to any government entity that wants to walk in the door and ask for the movements of a woman who has come to a blue state looking for an abortion.
One of the aspects that I think a lot of people don't give enough thought to is their vehicles. We live in America. It's really difficult to get by without a vehicle unless you're lucky enough to live in a city that is walkable and has decent public transit. And unfortunately, there are only a few of those. And the situation that that puts us in is that we have got not just the snitch in our pocket, but we've got the snitch on four wheels as well. What do we do about that and the end user license agreement that we are faced with the first time we turn our key that appears on our handy dandy iPhone-like screen in the center of our console?
It is difficult. I believe that Mozilla came forward with an analysis a few months ago of the vehicular data space. They were trying to help inform consumers on which car makers were better to go with. And their conclusion was, no, actually, all of you suck. We cannot possibly give anything other than a failing grade to any of you. But there has been this assumption that car makers can gather an increasing variety of data and that in turn, law enforcement can access that data with relatively little process. At the same time, there have been legislative initiatives that in the context of that mass data collection look very worrying. So for example, you may remember a couple of years ago, there was an infrastructure bill that was put out by Congress and that was a central plank of what Biden in the early years of his administration was looking to do. Massive bill, over 1,000 pages. There was one page of it that specified that by around now, all new cars manufactured in the United States would have to have some technological mechanism installed for detecting driver impairment and for enabling remote stopping of the engine in the context of a finding of driver impairment. Now, we're not saying that drunk driving isn't a serious thing. Of course, certainly, it's a serious thing. A lot of people die from it. On the other hand, a lot of the technologies that are promised in this space appear to be kind of vaporware-like. They're collecting a ton of data always, but it's not necessarily the data that you would need in order to achieve the end in view. And meanwhile, they're being extremely intrusive. So let me explain that. You've got this technological mandate in the law, written probably by somebody who is not a technical person. And they say, you know, driver impairment is bad. Do something technological with your wizardry to detect driver impairment. Well, how do you do that? There are a number of ways. You could, for example, install facial recognition equipped cameras within the car and apply an algorithm that classifies the driver as looking drunk or not. And then people who have exceptionally florid noses, for whatever reason, are out of luck, whether they are impaired at the time or not. You could have emotion recognition software, which purports to examine whether somebody is acting a bit impaired behind the wheel, or whether perhaps they are too angry or emotional to be safely able to drive. Now, this may be telling on myself a little bit here, but in truth, I have four children, and I cannot promise that at all times when I have been in my vehicle, my facial expression has been a model of quiet calm. You could have atmospheric sensors in the car that detect alcohol within the car because it's a volatile compound.
Sure.
And when it's above a certain level, they would stop the car. And that might be a little closer to what is required with respect to alcohol. But then on the other hand, what if you're a designated driver and you're transporting a gang of drunk teenagers because you had to go out and get them because nobody is going to want them to come home under their own steam in that condition? well, then you're going to get penalized and you're not going to be able to operate your car because there's now a legally mandated remote kill switch.
And of course, we all know that this legally mandated kill switch will never, ever be abused for any other purpose.
Absolutely not. Chuck, we just don't have that kind of government. What would make you think that they would use all of the technological capacities that they have to hand to shut down the physical movements or financial movements or activities in general of people they don't like? I can't imagine there being an extensive, decades-long history amply demonstrated by documentaries and historians and books shelves long as to why that might be a bad idea.
Yeah. Drawing a complete blank on that one myself.
Knew you would. But that vote was an interesting one, and I'll tell you why. There was a vote on an amendment to strip that language, and it didn't have much play in the press. And the amendment did not succeed in stripping that language. But two of the people who voted to strip that language were Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on the left and Thomas Massie on the right. And that showcases that both on the left and the right, there can be legislators who are alive to the privacy consequences of new technologies and who maybe understand these things a little better than some of their colleagues do.
The car makers will also be interested in monetizing whatever data they are able to collect over these tools.
Well, wouldn't that be unfortunate? But it would be a deeply regrettable incidental side effect that nobody, of course, intended that they could make some substantial profits out of that.
And I will, of course, include a link to the podcast episode in which I talk about exactly that happening when the insurers got a hold of this information.
Well, there you go. You see, everyone. It doesn't have to be done on the basis of segmentation anymore. You're in your own individual personalized segment for insurance purposes. And if you happen to be not just living in an area that has a high rate of car crime, but if you happen to be a person who triggers whatever software is installed for one reason or another, then sucks to be you, buddy.
So we've talked about the commercialization of data. We've talked about commercial surveillance, I should say, to be more specific. Talk to me a little bit about how the commercial data makes its way around the Fourth Amendment.
Well, this is a really interesting topic, so thank you for bringing it up. We need to think to begin with about the broad question of how does government gather the information that it wants? And remember, I'm a public policy guide. The whole notion of public policy is that government decisions will be better taken if they are based on data rather than if they are based on prejudice. And so the whole orientation of public policy as a field is let's get the right data to decision makers, and then they will make better decisions. It causes heartburn to my former grad school colleagues that I'm professionally now in a field where I'm often saying, no, you actually need to gather less data and then you will make better decisions. So what you find is that government processes to acquire information directly often require a warrant. There's a judicial process for it, and you have to go and demonstrate probable cause to a judge who will then, in their discretion, issue a warrant or not issue a warrant for you then to go and seize a person or their papers or their effects. And that is the structure of the Fourth Amendment. But if you can go to a provider, if you can go to a data broker, if you can do a geofence warrant and seize a huge amount of data on a huge amount of people and then winnow it down according to identifiers in the data, then you don't need a warrant for that. You're just purchasing a commercial data set and then applying algorithms to it. So because of that gap in the law, if you're in law enforcement or intelligence, you'd think this is great. This is fantastic. They can track down so many more of the bad guys than they could before, according to their data profiles. And why wouldn't they want to do it? And more to the point, why would it be helpful for some British-accented jackass to come into the room and tell them that they were doing something wrong by doing it.
You mentioned geofence warrants, and those are one of the things that I find concerning. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about those.
Right. So as I said, structure of the Fourth Amendment is the government has some sort of notion that you may be a person who is doing something wrong, that they may wish to prosecute for an actual crime. In order to seize your papers or effects, which include your communications, they need to go and get a warrant, and the warrant has to be particular as to the person and the thing or things to be searched or seized. That's the model. Geofence warrants turn that on its head. Instead, what you have is the government coming to Google and saying, something bad happened in this area that we want to investigate. It happened at this particular time. We want you to draw a line of 200 feet around where this incident occurred. And we want you to give us the mobile phone numbers, the cell phone numbers of all cell phones that passed through that geographical space within a time window of, let's say, an hour before and an hour after this event that happened. And then Google will do that. And then the government will look at those numbers and they will winnow it down and go and cross-reference those numbers in their extensive databases. And they will go back to Google and they'll say, okay, there's one or two of these numbers that are of particular interest to us. We want the location information of where these cell phones went over this longer period. And it might be like three or four of these phones. And then based on that pattern of movements, they go, okay, there's this person who may fit the crime. Let's go pick them up and see what they have to say about it. Now, that means that they're not starting with a person. They are starting with the crime and they're reasoning back. It is more efficient in many ways. The thing is that efficiency is not the only value that is of relevance. If you have a perfectly efficient data gathering and exploitation system that perfectly identifies everyone and where they are at any given moment, and then makes that information easily and seamlessly available to law enforcement, what you have is perfectly efficient policing in some sense, but what you also have is a police state. I have a caveat in my mind about this.
Okay.
There is actually a lot of wisdom in the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment is, in a sense, there not just to slow down policing, but to help policing, because it prevents them from being distracted by irrelevant stuff. Digital collection is so cheap and so easy that you can gather the haystack to your heart's content. But the more you gather the haystack, the more false positives you're going to get. Mm. Let me give you an example. I live in the Boston area, and the Boston area has something, a police entity called the Boston Regional Intelligence Center. It's a fusion center.
Okay.
For those who know what those are. Part of the mandate they've given themselves is to detect and document threats that are made online that do not rise to the level of illegality under the First Amendment. So they're not illegal things to say, but they might be indicators of future criminal activity. So they intercept a vast array of online comments that are to do with, well, sometimes it's people who are hashtagging the phrase Muslim Lives Matter. Sometimes it's people who are talking about firearms, and they flag this up in the system. And if something looks serious enough, that they go in. I remember a case where there was a 17-year-old teenager in Methuen, Massachusetts. He wanted to be a rapper more than anything in the world, and he called himself DJ Cammy D. And DJ Cammy D put up a rap lyric on his Facebook page, and his rap lyric, among other things, said, "Fuck the Boston bombing, I'm gonna go one better."
Oh, shit.
And what was this? This was like dumb teenage aspirant rap guy bravado. And DJ Cammy D was never going to be the person who was secretly plotting a series of murderous explosions in our local area. But he got arrested. misgraduation, threatened with charges of making criminal terroristic threats. Local law enforcement got extremely excited because they're like, we got one. Remarkably, the grand jury refused to indict. And this is a false alarm problem. The more that you collect, the more false alarms that you have. Honestly, this is America. People are talking shit online about how they want to kill their elected officials every day, thousands of times a day. I've lost count of the number of people that I know who have negative opinions about the incoming president and who sometimes express those in vehement ways. How on earth are you going to wade through all of that if you're collecting everything and then trying to winnow it down? So the philosophy behind the Fourth Amendment is that you don't do it that way. You don't start with mass collection because it's going to lead to you chasing your tail in case after case after case and harassing and making the lives miserable of people who may say dumb things on the internet. But who don't pose any realistic threat. You start instead with information that you have developed that a person may pose a realistic threat of committing an actual crime. And then you go seize their communications and see if that backs you up. Does it mean that you will sometimes miss stuff? Yes, it does. But does it also mean that you're not going to chase your tail on case after case? Yes, it also means that. So I think that there is a larger sense in which the Fourth Amendment is a friend to law enforcement if they choose to see it that way, and a friend to the intelligence services.
We're nearly out of time here, but before we go, I wanted to ask you if you would please give us a quick rundown of what RT4 is doing to improve the situation and how people can connect with the organization.
Yes. So it will not come as a surprise to people who are listening that the US government does collect and exploit vast arrays of data on US citizens. They do. They do their best to tie themselves into knots, to not describe it as that, but they do. The main mechanism whereby Congress considers what to do about this is FISA statute, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act statute, regularly comes up for renewal, and it expires if they don't do anything. Now, it's a lot easier to get Congress to not do anything than to get it to do something. If they are going to affirmatively renew it, then they have to actually consider whether it's a good idea and make the time in committee and on the floor to pass it. So what we have is a regular cycle where these powers come up for debate in Congress and members of Congress argue about what to do. We have just had one iteration of this cycle back in April of 2024. I am sorry to say in that cycle that they renewed surveillance powers and in some respects expanded them under FISA. But during the course of that, the vote was closer than it ever had been before. The vote came down to 212 to 212. Because it was an amendment vote, it lost with an even tie. We were actually ahead by one vote, and then the speaker went, oh my God, they're actually going to do something to help the American people. I need to weigh in right now. And he stepped in, voted against a warrant, and banged his gavel to close the vote right there, just to make sure. It had never been the case to that point. Now, after 212, this is really interesting here, two-thirds of the votes against a warrant were Democrats, and one-third of the votes against the warrant were Republicans. Similarly, of course, two-thirds of the votes for a warrant were Republicans, and one-third were Democrats. That was because the Biden administration went all out to pressure legislators to vote against a warrant for U.S. person communications. That's not how it was presented, by and large, in Democratic Party communications, but that is what they did. So now we have a new situation, right? The next renewal deadline comes up in April 2026. The Republicans are in charge. There's a Republican president. What are those two-thirds of Republicans going to do now? Are they going to continue to support a warrant for U.S. person communications when it is Republicans who are collecting and interpreting this data? Similarly, what are the Democrats going to do? How much of their opposition to a warrant was really like them feeling, oh, you know, Joe's got this, it's going to be okay. The right people are in charge, so we're sure they're not going to do anything bad with it. And how much are they going to change now that it's the Donald who is looking at this data and figuring out what to do with it and how many protesters to harass on the basis of it? There are going to be changes. The question is whether they'll go our way or they won't. It's balanced on a knife edge right now, Chuck. And it could go either way. That is why Restore the Fourth is going to be in there at the core of this fight, contacting members of Congress, trying to render the pro-reform legislators as powerful and as allied a caucus as they can, trying to not only do that, but also to pass data broker protections. Referring back to what we were talking about earlier, there's something called the Fourth Amendment is not for sale act. And what that says is very simple. The House already passed it. We just need them to repass it because we're in a new Congress. What it says is if the government wants to buy data from a data broker or buy data from a social media provider or whatever, if they just want to buy data on US persons and they would need a warrant to get it if they were acquiring it directly, well, then they need a warrant in order to buy it. It's not saying don't do it. It's just saying you can't weasel out of the protections of the Fourth Amendment just by saying, oh, it's fine, we're going to a third-party provider and paying them some money to get it for us. That's not how this works constitutionally. So warrant protections for U.S. persons' data. FBI doesn't get a free hand to dive into whatever the NSA collects for foreign intelligence purposes. The government, if they want to get U.S. persons' data, then they have to get a warrant for it if they would need a warrant to acquire it directly. And that is what we are looking for out of this Congress. And people can help. There are very few people who are actually paid people in this space whose paid job it is to advocate for Americans' privacy. And that is part of the problem. Because there are plenty of well-paid people out there advocating against Americans' privacy. So what we need more than anything else is volunteers who are knowledgeable enough about these systems that they know that there's a problem and who are willing to make calls to legislators and coordinate with us to reach out to people of both parties in Congress who might be willing to help pass these critical reforms. We're close. We're closer than we've ever been. I can feel it. And I believe that this can happen. But it's not going to happen without there being volunteers of goodwill involved in the process, because nothing ever happens without there being volunteers of goodwill. You know what I mean?
I do. Now, how does one volunteer?
That's very simple. You go to restorethefourth.com. That's fourth, four as a digit rather than spelled out. And there is a tab saying get involved. And you put information in there that will enable us to contact you. And I say that carefully because we cheerfully accept pseudonyms and acronyms just as long as we are able to contact you. And we will have a chat with you if you'd sign up and try to plug you in a way that you can do stuff that is practical and useful and that will not waste your time. This is a cause that is desperately important, a cause that gets desperately misreported in the press and that lawmakers make hay of because they don't understand it, or they pretend just that the more that we gather in terms of information, the safer we are. People like your audience, Chuck, and people like the people involved in Restore the Fourth, we understand that that's not so. And there are nearly enough lawmakers who are with us. We just need to get it over that hump.
Alex Matthews, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you very much, Chuck.
Alex Matthews is the national chairman of Restore the Fourth. Links mentioned in the interview, as well as a link to the full interview, can be found in the program notes. Homomorphic encryption is a collection of techniques that can be used to perform operations on encrypted data without ever decrypting the data. Data stored in a homomorphic database can be looked up using similarly encrypted information to retrieve encrypted information, keeping it encrypted the whole way. That sounds great, doesn't it? Truthfully, it's a very clever idea and has great potential for enhanced privacy. This is the technology that Apple introduced in iOS 18.1 and macOS 15.1 back in October. So far, so good. Now, using this technology, your iPhone and your MacBook are automatically scanning all of your photos, looking for salient details in them, identifying things about them, looking them up using a homomorphic database that Apple hosts and identifies what's in the picture. Isn't that fabulous? So, while all of this is going on encrypted, there remains one simple problem, which is that Apple have opted everybody into this. It doesn't matter if you wanted it or not, you get it. If you like it, great. But in liking it, know this. Even though the whole transaction is encrypted, Apple is, by definition, dealt in. What I mean by that is they have the keys to decrypt the transaction. This, my friends, is why I run Linux on my MacBook. It doesn't make assumptions about what conversations I want it having with the cloud. As much as I appreciate Apple's efforts with encryption, which I will tell you are epic, Apple also seems to like to tell you that you don't know what you want, they do. Think different, my ass. While we are on the subject of Apple, Siri recently bubbled up to the surface as the latest voice-controlled digital assistant to accidentally record conversations. Similar to the homomorphic image data search I mentioned a moment ago, Apple appears to have at least tried to do all of the right things with respect to user privacy, but the problem with voice assistants, and it doesn't matter which one, is that they can misinterpret intent. They can wake up in response to something that wasn't meant to wake them up. Let me demonstrate. I've done things like this before, so some of you may already know what's coming. Alexa, OK Google, Hey Siri, play Invasion of the Gabber Robots. Now, some of you have no doubt just gotten another demo of why I don't leave my voice assistant ready to go, or, for that matter, even on in the first place. Anyway, all your base are belong to us. So, the issue appears to be that Siri inadvertently recorded some private conversations. It appears that this happened when the voice assistant was inadvertently triggered by an action of the user, or something that your device heard, that got misinterpreted and woke it up. The accidental recordings were discovered by eerily focused advertisements being delivered to the users. In a world where people have to cross state lines to get some medical care, where people may be protesting, or even where people may be trying to just get surveillance for whatever reason to just fuck off, this is not acceptable. Apple have agreed to pay $95 million to settle the resulting lawsuit. Apple users are expected to receive about $20 apiece. All right, enough about phones. Let's talk about cars. Before I start down this rabbit hole, let's be clear on a point here. The exploding Tesla Cybertruck in Las Vegas was not cool. While I have no sympathy for the incoming president, I also have no sympathy for violent attackers. It's not how you make a point. If you want to see how poorly it works, all you have to do is look at the Middle East. So, what bothers me here, though, is the amount of information that Tesla were able to round up about this truck. Now, Tesla are not alone in this. As Alex mentioned earlier in this podcast, the Mozilla Foundation did a study of major car brands and concluded that from a privacy perspective, pretty much they all suck. His words. I will include a link to that study in the program notes. You will also note that back when we were talking about the pwns of this particular fortnight, Volkswagen was on the list, collecting all of the location information so that it could be stolen. But let's have a look at what Tesla was able to get from the exploded Cybertruck. From data collected by the company, they were able to reconstruct the terrorists' wandering path across the country and to gather diagnostic data that proved that the truck itself was not at fault for the explosion. Now, some folks may want law enforcement to have this kind of data when it is useful, as in this case. But it comes at what cost? Think about this for a second. Do you realize that the truck not only captured all of this information, but also uploaded it as the trip unfolded? Think about it. If the information had been stored locally on the truck and not transmitted to the cloud via whatever means, do you think that that information would have been intact? The fact that it is says that it was uploaded as the trip unfolded. And if you go back to the start of the show, as I mentioned a second ago, you will hear where I talked about Volkswagen getting pwned, exposing the location data of 800,000 of their cars. Now again, you may be tempted to say, this is good. I say no, because all of this information is being collected all the time by your car. And it's not the car manufacturer's fucking business. Between that and the constant parade of pwns that I report on this show, you should be very apprehensive about car makers collecting all of this information in the first place. Of course, the surveillance systems being installed in all of our cars without our clear consent and with scant options to opt out are not the only way to track a car. I've talked before about automatic license plate readers, or ALPRs, which do exactly what they sound like. You drive past a camera, and the camera captures your plate, and optical character recognition software gets your plate number. Well, in an amusing twist, security researcher Matt Brown found a security hole in some ALPR cameras made by Motorola, and has determined and demonstrated the ability of the general public to gather this information from these cameras and use it. While this does not solve the overall problem of ALPRs, which are yet another component of ubiquitous government and corporate surveillance, it does democratize it, at least for now, until they decide to patch it. Of course, at the root of this is that private networks where these devices live have been misconfigured, which means that there is also potential for the cameras to be used to pivot into a bigger pwn. I will, of course, do my due duty, and I will let you know if I hear of that happening. As usual, we will end the show with the fail of the fortnight. This week's award goes to Waymo. Waymo is a subsidiary of Alphabet, best known for being Google's parent company. The service that they provide in a limited number of markets is essentially an automated taxi service. When a passenger orders a ride from Waymo, an autonomous vehicle shows up to pick them up and takes them to their destination. That's how it's supposed to work anyway. Los Angeles tech entrepreneur Mike Johns posted a video on LinkedIn showing his call with Waymo customer service, where he was trying to get a glitch worked out. It seems that he had ordered a ride to take him to the airport from Scottsdale, Arizona. And when the car arrived and he got into it, it just started going around the parking lot and around the parking lot and around the parking lot and around the parking lot to the point where he was starting to seriously worry about missing his flight. Eventually, with the help of customer service and some struggle, he was able to get the car to pull over and stop. There is a happy ending, though. Sources say that he was able to make his flight. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fungaboo and the Helix Foundation for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 Group. Special thanks to Misdemeanor, Telegram Sam, Carol Baskin, Azriel, Kylo Ren, Thriller at Play, Knight Rider 007, and Joe Cadillac for story leads, and to Alex Marthews for appearing on today's show. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Punt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Fortnite music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker, and our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast, or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com or post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next time when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Episode 158 will drop on January 26th. Stay safe and be well.
The thing!